Hi, everyone. I'm Steve Christie. I work with the MITRE Corporation. I'm going to talk to you today about the Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures CVE initiative. Try and make it a simple thing, and it appears that way probably in terms of public reception, but there are some interesting complexities behind the scenes that go on. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Looks like BindView has managed to actually suck up everyone out of the conference, but that's okay. What I'm going to talk about initially is CVE at a glance. I'm going to talk briefly about what CVE is, why we think it's useful. I'm going to then talk about what the criteria for a good CVE are based on some research that was done about 2.5 years ago, and how well we're basically meeting those criteria. I'm going to talk a little bit about the CVE submission stage, which is how we actually generate things that go onto the list. It's something that MITRE does, but it happens pretty much behind the scenes. I'm also going to talk about content decisions, which are the criteria that we try and use to determine what goes into CVE, as well as how we count things effectively, how we distinguish between similar items. I'm going to talk about the CVE candidate stage. I'll talk a little bit about the process of reserving candidate numbers and some changes that we're doing with that. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, that's okay. I'll be explaining that in a little bit. I'll talk a little bit about the CVE entry stage. Once CVE items become official entries, they don't necessarily just sit there. There are some changes that might occur. I'm going to talk a little bit briefly about the basic, the fundamental piece of CVE that makes it useful, the name itself, and some things that we're doing to look at that name and certain choices that we made. I'm also going to give a little bit of a description of the top 10 types of vulnerabilities that we've seen within CVE in about the last 15 months. Okay, first of all, I just want to get a sense of where the audience is. Who here knows what CVE is? Could you raise your hand? Okay. How many of you use CVE on a periodic or regular basis? Okay. And do we have any researchers here who have discovered vulnerabilities that have made it into CVE, candidates included? Okay. All right, so I'm going to go briefly through some of what CVE is. Up here is a table of 10 different names for the classic PHF vulnerability, which was discovered in 95 or 96, something like that. These are 10 different names that 10 different organizations or products used for the same vulnerability. This is the problem that we're trying to solve. If you're trying to manage vulnerability information from all of these different sources, then you run straight into the problem of all of these different names. And this is PHF, folks. You know, this isn't SendMail or Internet Explorer or Bind or other things that have had a lot of different vulnerabilities over the year. So what we're trying to do with a common vulnerabilities and exposures list is get everyone to agree to use the same name. And what we have up here is CVE 1999-0067, so it's basically a number. The first component being the year in which the CVE was assigned, and the second one being a sequence number. So those things are pretty much content-free, and we did that on purpose. We didn't want people to argue about what was a good name or what wasn't a good name. We just wanted people to start agreeing to use the same thing, the same name. Included in CVE also is a short description, and we need to put in enough information into there to allow people to distinguish between other CVE entries and so on. However, these are generally much shorter, as you, those of you who use CVE have noticed. These are much shorter than what you would normally see in a vulnerability database. We don't have a need to give you all of that extra information on our end, because the focus, again, is just to get people to agree to use the same name. Finally, in the very early days of CVE, we just assumed that a name and a description would really be sufficient for allowing people to really distinguish between different kinds of vulnerabilities. However, we've since learned that really these references, pointers to things like CERT advisories, Microsoft security bulletins, and so on, can often become really, really important, especially when you have software that's had a lot of vulnerabilities that's been discovered over the years. CVE is supported by the CVE Editorial Board, which is a group of about 40 individuals from a number of different organizations who help to review items that go onto the CVE list. They help to define the process, and they help to encourage the adoption of CVE within the community. As you can see, we've got a fairly diverse set of board members from different kinds of organizations. And you probably recognize at least a couple of the names up there. So we're glad that we've gotten this kind of support. It really is a community effort. This is one way that we see being able to use CVE within the context of enterprise security. Suppose you have security bulletins out there that you care about that give you a set of vulnerabilities that you care about fixing, getting rid of within your enterprise. You might have a scanner or two available to you to go out and look through your enterprise to find those vulnerabilities. You might have access to websites or external databases that that you might use to get additional information. And you may use intrusion detection systems to go and spot exploitation of those vulnerabilities there. Given that there are thousands of vulnerabilities out there, think of those 10 different names that I had for PHF. That's a little bit problematic if you're trying to manage different tools from different vendors using different terms. So this is why we're trying to encourage tool vendors to use CVE. So let's say for a moment that you have security bulletins that are identifying three different vulnerabilities that you care about. If those security bulletins used CVE names, you could then quickly go and take an inventory, effectively, of what capabilities you have in your tools. So looking here, for example, our vulnerability scanner doesn't check for CVE-3. Fortunately, however, our intrusion detection system does. So even though we can't necessarily spot the presence of that particular CVE vulnerability from the scanning side, at least we might have a fighting chance of seeing if someone goes and tries to exploit it. So let's say I run my scanner, and I go and I look on my network, and I find a particular system with CVE-1 present. On the other hand, I have another situation where my scanner doesn't find CVE-3, and yet it might actually be out there on my network. We'll be coming to that back to that in a minute. Okay, I know that my scanner can't even find CVE-3. In addition, maybe I need to find some additional patch information for CVE-1. So I could use these CVE names to go out to CVE-compatible databases or websites, and there are a number of them out there, using just the CVE name to find the additional information. In addition, I happen to know that my intrusion detection system, I can quickly tell, doesn't detect any attacks on CVE number 2. So I'm pretty dependent on my scanner to do a good job of finding CVE-2 for me. In addition, I could use a scanner from one vendor, have it communicate by feeding into the intrusion detection system of another vendor by saying, these machines have these particular vulnerabilities on them. So let's consider a few different attack scenarios. Let's say somebody tries to exploit CVE-1 on a particular system. Well, if my scanner has notified my IDS appropriately, then why should my IDS send an alarm if that particular system doesn't have that vulnerability? This is one way that you might be able to knock down a number of false positives if you had this type of information exchange across all of your different tools. Considering a different attack scenario where someone tries to exploit CVE-2 on the network, well, my IDS isn't going to see that, I happen to know. So I'm pretty dependent on my scanner to find that for me. And let's consider the unfortunate incident, which of course never ever happens in the real world, where someone actually tries to exploit a particular vulnerability, manages to succeed. In this case, I'm very heavily dependent on my IDS to do that for me. Okay? This is a small example with just three different vulnerabilities. But if you're taking care of security in your enterprise, you probably care about hundreds, if not thousands, of vulnerabilities. CVE is a way of helping you to manage problems of a larger scale than the example I've given you here. Another thing that we believe CVE allows you to do is to compare like products with each other. If you had two competing, let's say, vulnerability scanners that compared to, you could compare them against each other using CVE. In this particular case, looking down the column, tool A would be more comprehensive than tool B with respect to the CVEs that I care about. Well, why not just take what the marketing people tell you is the number of vulnerabilities that their scanners check? What you might have noticed is that scanners and intrusion detection systems count vulnerabilities differently. One thing that I did a few years ago was compare a couple market-leading scanners. One of them advertised 500 vulnerabilities, another advertised 300. And when I actually got down and compared them side by side, it turned out that they were actually pretty equivalent. They just counted things differently. If we have people using CVE in their scanners, you at least have a standard fixed way of being able to count things and coming up with metrics that are reasonably repeatable. In addition, in this case, let's say you happen to know what the most exploited vulnerabilities are, this third row here, CVE number three. If I happen to know the CVE names for those vulnerabilities that are being exploited widely, then I can go and quickly look for the scanners that are out there that maybe check for those, or the IDSs that can find them. These are ways for me to find little chinks in my armor, so to speak, for my enterprise network defense. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what the criteria for a good CVE is. We introduced this concept, me and a partner, David Mann, from MITRE, at the second workshop on vulnerability databases at Purdue in January 1999. And in that, at that time, we didn't know that it was MITRE that was going to be doing the CVE stuff. We just knew something like that had to be done. So we outlined four different criteria for what a good CVE would do to help you achieve the goals that I discussed in previous slides. So first of all, this is a pretty obvious one. We want to be able to enumerate and discriminate between all known vulnerabilities. Secondly, we want to assign a standard, unique name to each vulnerability so that everyone can use that name. And because we want the naming space to be out there, we need the list itself to be open and shareable without any distribution restrictions. And then finally, and this is one of the real challenges, we wanted to exist independently of the multiple perspectives of what a vulnerability is. What we keep finding over and over again is that everyone has a different definition, a different notion of what a vulnerability is. As we started developing the CVE concept, we had a few design considerations that we brought into play. One of them was to be as simple as possible. We wanted to minimize the amount of workload that we had to do, the amount of overlap with existing vulnerability database efforts as well. And with the editorial board, we wanted to minimize the amount of workload that they would wind up doing. In addition, it's important to support the lookup of CVE names. And I'll talk about a couple tricks that we do to do that later. Really try and involve diverse players across the security community. And you saw some of that diversity in the editorial board. A lot of different types of individuals and organizations coming from a lot of different angles who are still operating in the vulnerability space. So let's look at a little bit more detail at criterion one, just list and discriminate between all known vulnerabilities. Well, one issue that crept up pretty early on was, well, what's a vulnerability in the first place? And while the common vulnerabilities and exposures name that it has today is kind of clunky, once upon a time it used to be called common vulnerability enumeration. turns out, though, that what we were trying to do with helping integrate information from multiple security tools is that there were a lot of things that security tools looked at or checked or so on that a lot of people didn't consider vulnerabilities. So this resulted in some terminological warfare across different members of the CV editorial board in terms of what was a vulnerability or what wasn't a vulnerability. In addition, should CVE even include things that weren't vulnerabilities? We hemmed and we hawed over the summer of 1999 and finally hit upon this concept of exposure, which now Bruce Schneier is also using in a completely different way, but oh well, that's life. The notion of an exposure in the CVE context is a security problem or concern that doesn't necessarily directly allow access to a system, but could be used as a stepping stone. So information is a good example, and our favorite whipping boy happens to be running Finger. The purpose of Finger is, you know, to list all the users on a system. That's not directly going to allow someone to break into it, but knowing who the users are that are on a system certainly is a useful piece of information. And that's something that a lot of security tools will look at and report on, and it's what a lot of people who care about enterprise security care about. No, it's not, you know, the latest major buffer overflow, but it's still important. So there are some URLs there for some interesting discussions, I think, with all of these debates that happened. The key point here is that vulnerability definitions really vary widely. So the idea of us trying to discriminate between all known vulnerabilities was a challenge in and of itself because we couldn't get everyone to agree what vulnerabilities were. So now we've got this more slightly amorphous thing. Okay, well, what if someone reports something, says it's a problem, but we don't necessarily even know if it's real or not? An interesting stat that I discovered is that approximately 50% of all reported security problems are not acknowledged by the security vendor, or rather by the affected software vendor. 50%. So there are a lot of different explanations for that probably, but nonetheless, that's about 50% of the reported vulnerabilities that we aren't even sure the vendors know about that might not even be real necessarily. In addition, you have a lot of vulnerabilities that are discovered in fairly obscure software or by researchers who haven't necessarily established credentials. Look at a lot of the posts to BugTrack, for example. You know, there's no slight against any of the people who post to BugTrack. You know, 95% of the stuff that's posted there, 100% of the stuff that's posted there may in fact be real. But if you're someone who's trying to manage this large space of vulnerabilities, and you see a post from someone posting from a Hotmail account, for example, you don't necessarily have a lot of confidence as to whether that issue is real or not. Unfortunately, it's also very resource intensive just to try and verify each report. You have to have the software, or you have to at least know people who are running the software. You have to come up with an exploit, or you have to debug the exploit that you might have found, those kinds of things. So one of the fundamental questions that we're asking nowadays, after a bit of reflection and a bit of realization of the scope of the problem, is if something is reported but we aren't necessarily sure if it's real or not, should it still be included in the CVE list? That's a debate that we've been having and we'll continue to have over the next few months. It's at least going to get reviewed. Those of you who know what candidates are, if it's something that's reported, it's at least going to get a candidate number. The question is which things go into the official list, become official entries. And regardless, how much verification are we really going to want to go through in terms of deciding whether something's real or not? Is it just sufficient that something got posted somewhere? Or does someone on the editorial board have to have actually verified the problem themselves? Different kinds of questions here. So let's consider one particular extreme example. Some denial of service vulnerability was discovered in SendMail, these two particular versions, reported a few years ago to BugTrack. The vendor himself said, I can't replicate this. There was a long thread on BugTrack dealing with a lot of other issues, but no one else spoke up and said, yes, I was able to replicate this issue. Nonetheless, this particular denial of service in SendMail vulnerability is in a number of different security tools. Now, why is that? When the vendor himself isn't necessarily even sure that it's real. If you saw Renaud Duraison's talk on Nessus earlier today, he talked a bit about banner checking. If your tools just go and look at banners, then all you need to do is go and connect to a SendMail server, get its version, compare that, and then report a vulnerability or not. So this is one particularly extreme example of a vulnerability, or maybe a vulnerability, that a lot of people take for granted. That's the level of noise, so to speak, that's in this space. So it's directly affecting us at CVE. Okay. Let alone whether it's real or what a vulnerability is, what is a known vulnerability? What is the space of reported vulnerabilities out there that we want to deal with? Well, first of all, CVE needs to be public. If everyone's going to use the same name, it has to be public. So immediately we need to restrict ourselves to publicly known vulnerabilities. There's a lot of people out there, a lot of organizations that go out and collect vulnerability information, populate their own databases, release weekly or biweekly summaries of vulnerabilities. I'm sure a lot of you are subscribed to those. So we rely on them to provide us with their list of vulnerabilities. And we take that and build effectively the master list. Now, each of these different sources makes their own editorial decisions as to what to include in their lists or not. We don't entirely have that luxury, but there is a wide variety across all of the different sources that we collect information from. So we sort of get a grand set that hopefully is comprehensive enough so that anyone using CVE, any vulnerability that they report ultimately has a CVE name associated with it. Another challenge, though, is that there are some vulnerabilities that aren't announced through normal public sources that might have a notion of peer review or high confidence, such as cert advisories or post a bug track. You know, is something that got dumped on PacketStorm that's written in broken English with some exploit that may or may not work, is that something that is known enough, so to speak, for us to try and at least attach a CVE or a candidate number to it? You know, what are the thousands of hacker sites that theoretically one would need to go out to try and make sure that they were absolutely complete? So we're relying on our data sources to be doing that, the bulk of that work for us. However, that's not always going to succeed. In the case of the IIS Unicode vulnerability, for example, a lot of people think that Rainforest Puppy discovered that, but he didn't. He just happened to see something that posted to PacketStorm. And it took him a couple hours to actually figure out that it was a real report. So even what is a known vulnerability is a challenge. So we get our vulnerability information to populate the CVE list from various sources. And we sort of hold that internal within MITRE. We convert them into these things called submissions from these different data sources. We then take all of the submissions from all of the different sources, there's probably a lot of overlap between them. And then we match these submissions all against each other. And I'm going to go into a little bit more detail in a minute. And then we take each group of matched submissions, which all either discuss a single vulnerability or very closely related vulnerabilities, and then we refine them into CVE candidates, things that ultimately get a number and get proposed to the editorial board for discussion. With respect to conversion, the data format for submissions is often pretty unique to the source. So we might get some things in a text-based email. We might get other things in a CSV format. We don't forbid all of these sources from using their own names. They use their own names for vulnerabilities for their own purposes. But we record that information. I'll get back to why we record that sort of information in a minute. So let's consider this example where we have three different sources of information. One of the things that one of our evolving design considerations that I alluded to was we need to make it easy to look up a CVE name. What that translates into partially is we need to account for the fact that different people will use slightly different spellings of an individual application or security vulnerability or so on. So what we do is for each raw submission, we convert that into a whole set of keywords. We use the references and whatever descriptions and short names that might be in the submission. We don't treat periods or hyphens as word separators in this space, like a lot of search engines would. Think about version numbers, 2.4. You want that to be treated effectively as a single word, not a 2 and a 4. Think about dashes and how often they appear in application names or on the Unix command line within particular Unix commands. What we use is the CVE thesaurus to help convert each of these keywords into one official word. So take, for example, buffer overflow, which some people call buffer overrun. Same thing. So we convert all instances of the phrase buffer overrun into buffer overflow. One of my favorite examples here is a command called pfdispally, D-I-S-P-A-L-Y, that a lot of people out there probably think is actually called pfdisplay. Well, turns out, near as I can tell, looking at the official SGI advisory for this, whoever created that program put in a little typo, near as I can tell. So the actual name of that program is pfdispally, yet a lot of people see it and immediately read it as pfdisplay, call it pfdisplay. If you go and look for pfdisplay on the CVE website, it'll convert that into pfdispally as the official one. Another thing about pfdisplay is you'll actually see that in a number of CGI scanners. Someone somewhere saw it as pfdisplay, stuck it into their CGI scanner, and everyone else who wrote their own CGI scanner copied that, so it's kind of interesting. WUFTP, three or four different ways that someone might spell it just for the same application. Same thing for Internet Explorer. And we've got hundreds of things like this, hundreds of little tricks that we try and do to at least normalize the space of keywords. Once we've done that, we have our normalized submission that has these standard sort of keywords. We then perform what's called submission matching. Each submission that we're dealing with, we match against the space of all other submissions, the other CVE candidates and entries, other CVE items themselves. And we do some basic information retrieval stuff, weighted sums that basically favors keywords that are more rare. So, WFTP, relatively speaking, is more rare than buffer overflow is as a keyword. So this generally tends to cluster things based on application or, in some cases, version number. So we'll sometimes get false positives on version number just because you have vulnerabilities in completely different packages that happen to have the same version number. We then, for each submission, the 10 closest matches based on this algorithm are generated. And then a human goes and reviews them and says, okay, looking through this list of 10, this one here looks like a match, this one here looks like a match, and so on. And we do this for each submission. Due to the way the algorithm works, when you're looking at one submission, let's say you're looking at submission B1 here, that might show up in the matches, the top 10 matches for submission C1, as you see in the box on the right-hand side. But the converse isn't necessarily true. C1 wouldn't necessarily always show up in the top 10 closest matches for B1. We then take all of these match submissions. We know that A equals B, B equals C, and so on. And then we do a transitive closure. Basically, we just take all of the submissions that have been matched against all others and combine those into groups of related submissions. This helps us to... This gives us a number of different data points that we can then work with. One submission might have one reference, another submission might have a different set of references, one might describe the problem a little bit better than another one. We've got a lot of different data points there to work with. And in addition, there might be some very similar vulnerabilities in very similar, if not the same, versions of software, we at least have all of that information together collected into a single place. Now the problem is trying to figure out how we actually distinguish between those different things in this refinement phase. And that requires a lot of deep analysis, going and looking at source code, looking at exploits, reading through all of the different vulnerability reports, going to all of the different references, relying on past experience. In some cases, or in many cases, when we get submissions, there aren't any candidates, there aren't any things named with CVE yet. So our task becomes collecting all the references from all those different sources, because those references might be what people better know something by. You might know something better by a cert advisory than by what the CVE name is. We write the description, and we apply these things called content decisions, consistency rules, and I'll get into that in a minute. In other cases, we might have submissions that are already related to something that's in CVE, and that's a useful piece of information as well. Those submissions might have additional references that we could use, for example. This is the biggest bottleneck that we deal with in terms of even just getting to the point of assigning candidate names, the early names, to these CVE things. And that's one of the reasons why it might be a delay of a month or more before an initial CVE candidate name comes out after initial reports. We're depending on the other data sources to feed us. Some of the challenges that we face within this refinement, one of them is really identifying duplicate issues. You need to go really far down into the weeds, and sometimes the information just isn't there. You might get down to the point of looking at source code and diffs and change logs. There might be a single line entry in a change log that says fixed security problem. Well, which of the three reported security problems did it actually fix? You don't necessarily know. Security advisories, even the best and most comprehensive ones that are out there, sometimes lack sufficient details to be really certain whether they're talking about this vulnerability or that vulnerability. Consider the practice of a number of vendors of crediting the researcher who discovered a problem. A lot of those researchers' names keep coming up over and over again, right? They might have found multiple vulnerabilities within the course of just a month or two or a few months, and once the vendor gets to the point where they've actually patched the problem and published it, you don't know which of the three vulnerabilities that the researcher has found in that product is actually being addressed by the bulletin. So one thing that we're discovering, though, is by working more closely with vendors, the vendors know the answer to this. So we're trying to work more with the vendors in order to consult them on that. There can also be delays between the initial discovery of a problem and the later security advisory as well, and that can pose some challenges. You know, if you have a vendor who's very slow in responding to something, they might not acknowledge a vulnerability post an advisory until 6 months, maybe even a year after the initial vulnerability report. Are you really sure that they're fixing the problem that was reported 6 months or a year ago, or they found some other problem that they're fixing? You can't necessarily be sure. That's some of the challenges that we face with respect to CVE. That's a challenge that anyone who's trying to manage vulnerability information from a lot of different sources really faces. We're hoping that CVE will help to clear that up. If you have a bunch of different advisories, all of which use CVE names in them, then you can immediately see whether they're really talking about the same problem or not. Another thing is that what the researcher sees who reported the vulnerability versus what is actually going on under the hood based on what the vendor knows can be completely different. The researcher knows, this is especially the case in closed source, the researcher knows, I tried this attack, it caused this thing to crash, and therefore I conclude that the problem is here. Oftentimes you'll run into the vendor saying, some malformed input can be provided which will cause this particular module that the researcher never actually identified to cause a problem. And we've observed a number of cases where what the researcher reports and what the vendor reports are so different that we wind up creating actually two separate candidates. And if we're doing that in CVE, then the vulnerability databases that you're using are doing that too. It's just a problem with a lot of noise and lack of really good low-level information, having that available to you, that can be a challenge. And we sort of have to bear the brunt of that because we're kind of at ground zero. Unique and application-specific vulnerabilities are a real pain. PHP, for example, has certain kinds of vulnerabilities that are fairly unique to it. Internet Explorer's security model can be a challenge to understand. It's enough to cause you to try and tear out your hair. And as you see, I've done that several times over previous years. There's just too much information out there, too. So that's a real challenge just to manage all of that. In addition, we don't have the luxury of long descriptions. So we write these fairly terse descriptions, and yet we need to include enough information in there to allow you to distinguish between all the different CVEs. And then writing and following good consistency rules. Those consistency rules are called content decisions. They're really explicit guidelines that we try and publicize for what goes into CVE and what it looks like. And one of the reasons for that is so that other people can understand how we develop CVE and what inherent biases, so to speak, there are in there. You know, I talked about the vulnerability scanners count where one had 500 vulnerabilities and another one had 300. What we're trying to do with CVE is at least document the way that we come up with whatever numbers we do. There are three different types of content decisions. One of them is called an inclusion content decisions. What goes into CVE, what doesn't. Another type of content decision is abstraction. There are often cases where this comes into play when with having people talking about different kinds of vulnerabilities or different numbers of vulnerabilities. You might look at a particular problem and say, that's one vulnerability. Someone else might look at the exact same set of information and say, no, that's actually two or three vulnerabilities. So with respect to the CVE content decisions, we're trying to document which choices we actually make along the way. These things are pretty difficult to document, though. There are a lot of exceptions. Trying to deal with missing information is a challenge. So as one editorial board member had put it, it's like trying to grasp wet cornstarch to really understand and write these things in a way that's understandable. This goes on in any place that does vulnerability database development, but it doesn't necessarily make it outside of the vulnerability database team themselves. We're trying to formalize it because we've got a wide user base here. Incomplete information really is the challenge, and I talked a little bit about that. So I'm going to talk about one particular content decision related to different lines of vulnerabilities that might occur on different lines of code. These are really affected by the amount of available information that there is there. Basically, if you have problems in the same program or software that are of different types, well, clearly those are two different distinguished vulnerabilities. Everyone pretty much agrees that it's important to distinguish between those. So we'll do that. On the other hand, if you have vulnerabilities that appear in different software versions, that's an important thing to distinguish as well. To give you a couple examples here, the top two candidates deal with a CGI program called Auction Weaver that had a standard .. directory traversal vulnerability in two separate parameters. In another case, we have just a single candidate here. That talks about a buffer overflow, basically, in two separate mail commands. So there's even some inconsistency up here that is really more of a reflection of our growing understanding of what we should really be doing. But this is the sort of inconsistency you'll see in a lot of different databases. And why is that important? Well, do you want to count 500 vulnerabilities or 300? Again, this is why we think of content decisions as being pretty important. Another example here is some Cisco Arrowpoint vulnerabilities that were discovered and announced in January or so. In this case, these two particular candidates discuss completely different vulnerabilities, so we separate those. Yet for this 2001-019 vulnerability, there was a problem that was exploitable through six different combinations of commands and arguments. That could be one vulnerability, that could be two vulnerabilities, that could be six vulnerabilities, depending on how you count and depending on what the underlying source code actually looks like. So this is an example as an exercise for the reader, but just count the string copies. This is one of the challenges that we face with respect to dealing with vulnerabilities in open source as well as closed source, because the amount of information available to us is different. We have similar challenges when we're trying to deal with vulnerabilities that appear in multiple executables as part of the same software package. Consider these two scripts, PHP scripts called mlog and mylog. They both appeared in the same package. They had basically the same one vulnerable line of code. Could have been a cut and paste error or something like that. We run across these a lot too. So sometimes two candidates get produced, sometimes one gets produced. There are other examples. For example, how do you deal with passwords? Should there be a single item that says the stupid sysadmin didn't disable the default password on, you know, whether it was a router or a Unix system or a Windows system application, whatever? Or should we separate each individual application, each individual platform that had that particular problem on there? What the difference between the answer there is either we have one thing in CVE or we have hundreds, if not thousands. Configuration problems, also a big challenge. And this was where a lot of the differences in my analysis of security scanners came into play. Think of all the different privileges that are available in Windows NT. What is it, like 27, 30, something like that. Is a bad assignment of a privilege, do we distinguish between each individual privilege and create a different entry for each one, or do we just combine them all into a single entry? You're talking about the difference between one CVE or 30. And that's where a lot of these differences come into play in terms of scanners. So these abstraction-related content decisions really do matter. Inclusion CDs, one example here is problems in beta products. People might not report them. A lot of people might assume that you don't care about them. On the other hand, what about things like ICQ that are in permanent beta? Or software that's, beta release, but it's deployed on, you know, thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of systems. How about things that cause a denial of service in a client? You know, in a remote client. You send some weird packet to someone's, instant messenger. What happens? It crashes. They just bring up instant messenger again. A lot of people don't think that that's serious enough. On the other hand, you got to be careful about buffer overflows that get reported as denial of service problems. Take, for example, a Microsoft problem in a vCard that was reported originally in the summer of 2000 as a denial of service because the person who reported it hadn't necessarily coded an exploit. 6 months later, AtStake actually coded an exploit, showed that it was a genuine problem. So if we just go and categorically say anything that causes a denial of service to a client that doesn't impact the rest of the system, we should ignore, we're kind of ignoring some potentially important things here. Oh, we're up at criterion number 2, and I've got about 5 minutes left, so slower even than I had thought. As I said, and as those of you who are CV users may know, there is this delay between when a problem is initially announced and when we actually wind up getting to the point of assigning candidate number to that. We're trying to change that, though, a bit. And one of the ways that we're trying to change that is by allowing organizations or individuals to reserve candidate numbers from us before publishing things to then include in their initial advisories. So if you read, for example, advisories from AtStake or ISS or NAI or CERT or Microsoft or a number of other different organizations, those first-time publications of those advisories will often include candidate numbers in there. So that way you get your candidate numbers as soon as the problem itself gets published. We're working on expanding that. I'm skipping a lot of things here. You can look in your notes if you wish, but one of the things that I want to announce here is that those of you who are researchers, If you do responsible disclosure, whatever that means, but basically work with a vendor, try and work with a vendor to disclose vulnerabilities, then you can come to us and get a candidate number before you announce your vulnerability and include that candidate number in your post to BugTrack or your announcements to CNN or whatever. In addition, you might have seen the phrase candidate numbering authorities floating by as I was running through the slides. Other organizations we're working with to give them basically blocks or pools of candidate numbers so that if you don't want to come to MITRE to get a candidate, you can go to someone else to do that. One example of that is Microsoft. We give them a block of candidate numbers. People might report problems to them. They go and they include those candidate numbers in their security advisories. We're trying to expand that to a lot of software vendors, other organizations such as CERT, for example. We want to get those candidates out as soon as possible. The candidate and entry stages are documented on the CVE website. How has CVE been growing? Notice the green here is the number of candidates that we have left to process, and the blue is the number of entries that have been created. Notice that our total amount of workload for the candidates really isn't going down very much. At least it's not we have half of them are candidates and half of them are entries. I think we finally reached that breaking point where we've got more entries than candidates. On the other hand, we have probably about 3,000 or 4,000 things, new candidates that we need to create for legacy issues, those things that were discovered in 1999 and earlier. You know, we only started in CVE in 1999, but there is a good chunk of vulnerabilities that were discovered before then. The name itself can pose some challenges if you like look at it in a search engine, or people can assume that the year portion of that name means the year that the issue was discovered. There are other kinds of issues related to that. So we're actually thinking about changing the name itself to make it something that's easier to look up, that doesn't necessarily provide any information that people might misconstrue. There are some cases where the name itself might provide additional information, such as, say, how long someone has known about a vulnerability and reserved a candidate for before they've released something. On the other hand, any change that we make to this scheme is going to affect a lot of people in a lot of different organizations. So we have to be careful about that. But it's better for us to do it sooner rather than later. So we're going to try and learn from these mistakes that we made, so to speak, in the first few years and change that. Criteria number three, to be open and shareable. Some of the things that we're open about are discussions on the editorial board mailing list. A lot of these issues that I'm talking about have been discussed fairly extensively in public archives of the editorial board mailing list. Some interesting things come up that way. Board members, when they review candidates before approving them as official CVE entries, will often include a number of comments. So if you happen to download the candidates list and you're wondering why CAN 1999-0001, yes, the very first item that had a name associated with it, hasn't actually been promoted to an official entry, well, you can look in the comments section and see what some of the reasons for some of the delays are. The content decisions really is a big factor. It's only after these couple years that we have a good enough understanding of how we should write the content decisions and how we should apply them in a way that's reasonably consistent. In addition, we have these things called reference maps. If you want to look at what the CVEs are for all of the CERT advisories, for example, we have a CERT reference map that lists the CERT identifiers and then the associated candidates. Similar thing for BugTrack IDs, major vendor security bulletins, and so on. Some of the challenges that we face are, for example, documenting these evolving approaches that we have, like content decisions. There's a lot of work that really does go into this pretty simple-looking flat list that you see. And managing expectations as well can be a challenge. You know, there are a lot of different users, a lot of different consumers of CVE coming at it from a lot of different angles. Some statistics that I thought might be interesting. These are the top 10 types of vulnerabilities that we discovered that were reported in CVE for security problems that have been publicized between January 2000 and April 2001. That's a 15-month period. We looked at a total of 1,540 CVE entries and candidates. So do a little bit of math. That's over 100 security issues reported per month. I know a lot of you probably know that, but that's certainly the case in CVE. At least you have a general notion of how we're counting things now, too. Buffer overflows, the good old classic buffer overflows, been around for decades as far as the security gurus tell me. 25% of them, still. 25% of all the reported problems in that 15-month period that we captured with CVE were buffer overflows. A lot of these aren't necessarily very surprising. Dot, dot problems, directory traversal come into number two. Malformed input denial of service was sort of a weird one that I was kind of surprised about. You know, let's say you have an application that's expecting, an alphanumeric value for a field or something like that. What happens if you stick in a bunch of null characters? Or, it's expecting something, a number between 1 and 20, and what if you put in the number 55 or something like that? That's a fairly high-level class, but it turns out that there are a lot of different problems that that are related to this type of malformed input. Yes, is there a question? Yeah, okay. The question was that we've categorized these clearly, and are there things like breakdown by vendor and product and so on? First of all, these categorizations are things that we keep in terms of internal statistics. They aren't actually publicly available, unfortunately, and I know the irony of me saying that. But we want to avoid potential competition, so to speak, and overlap with other vulnerability databases. So that kind of information is useful for us internally in terms of tracking the progress of CVE. And of the software vulnerability world as a whole, but that's not really available. These other kinds of breakdowns that you're talking about, like by vendor and so on, are also capabilities that are generally available in vulnerability databases. And so, while we recognize that would be something that would be very useful on the CVE side of things to minimize overlap with those databases, a number of which are commercially oriented, who we want to be speaking CVE, who we don't want to compete with, therefore, we can't do that sort of thing. So that can be a challenge sometimes, though, because there are some really important kinds of information that would make CVE more usable that nonetheless we need to stay away from. In terms of looking at some of these other problems here, not a lot of surprises necessarily. Format string vulnerabilities have only been around for a year. They were only around for 12 months out of the 15-month period here, and yet they're number seven. Insecure permissions are up there, as well as bad encryption, whether it's poor implementations of encryption algorithms, whatever. And a classic CGI problem in terms of trusting form fields. If I have a shopping-related CGI that trusts what price gets sent to it, well, if I'm a malicious attacker who wants to buy a Porsche for $20, I can go to some e-commerce site, get the CGI, the price field says, 50,000 or whatever. I go and maliciously change that and resubmit the form, and it trusts the $50 that I typed in there. That kind of problem is fairly common enough that it's one of the top 10 problems. Now, these top 10 cover 60% of the CVE items that we used for this particular study. So, and there's probably another 20% or 25% that either we don't know how to classify or we just don't have enough information to really do that. So I think what I'm going to do at this point is I'm going to go very, very quickly through some of the different perspectives that we need to manage. Some people want things to go into CVE as soon as possible, make things official, and then if we realize that something is wrong, sort of clean it up later. Others want us to get things right the first time. We've got all of those old legacy issues that we need to deal with. Some people think that's really important. Other people think it's really important for us to stay as up to date quickly as possible. with respect to new issues. People like the academic research community have specific needs, specific ideas that they're looking to CVE to do. On the other hand, there are people like system administrators who don't necessarily care about separating between each individual bug. They just care about what patches they need to apply, regardless of how many bugs those may or may not fix. Competing points of view that we just simply can't navigate through. There might be people who are like traditionalists, so to speak, who only really care about software flaws, your classic programming errors, things like configuration errors. Someone might take an anti-admin perspective. You know, well, an administrator can screw up their system in a whole bunch of different ways. We don't necessarily want to go through documenting the infinite number of ways that people can mess things up. Scanners see things, and they care a lot about not only vulnerabilities, but other aspects of your network, which are other situations that might conflict with your security policy within your enterprise. On the other hand, IDSs care about attacks, exploits, signatures. You know, they don't really think in terms of vulnerabilities. It's really in terms of what the attacks are. Then we get a lot of miscellaneous questions and comments like, well, what about wireless? What about telecommunications? Those are computers too, a lot of them. Is that going to be in CVE? How about viruses? The CSV format is insufficient. It would be nice to have it in XML format, and we are planning on doing that. And then there's managing what everyone basically says, which is, give me everything I want, don't give me anything I don't, based on my own needs yesterday or at the very worst today. So how do we try and manage all of that? Well, we consult the editorial board. They're a good cross-section of the community, and they're smart, and they like to argue. We listen to the users as much as we can, and I'll be glad to talk to anyone after this. We reprioritize when possible. Every time we have an editorial board meeting, every time we go to a conference, we reevaluate the direction that we're headed in. We try and maximize the utility of CVE as much as possible, but hopefully you get a sense of what some of the challenges are that we face with respect to really trying to do that. We document and educate when we can. We please everyone some of the time. We can't please everyone all of the time, so we have to grow a thick skin and get used to it. So that's the basic deal about CVE. I'm not sure how much time we have for questions or if the other is the other speaker here? It is break time, okay. How about just one question? Anybody with one question? No questions. Well, I don't know whether that's good or bad. Thank you.